This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello. I want to continue the conversation that has started this morning. Have you tried to ask an aged care facility what their policy is when it comes to voluntary assisted dying? As we've heard this morning, Go Gentle, an advocacy group, conducted a report that revealed quite a lack of information, transparency, or at least they found after trying many, many times, they could not even find out information about what the facility's stance towards voluntary assisted dying is. We're going to dig into what your rights are in this circumstance and whether this is contrary to the spirit of the voluntary assisted dying laws as envisioned by the laws architects. We're going to speak to Fiona Patton, who moved that first motion back in 2015. But tell us about your lived experience in this. Has it made a difference to choosing an aged care home when you are choosing them to know what their stance is? What might happen? Whether or not if your loved one or if you are choosing that, whether you'll be able to stay there for that to happen, I'd love to hear your stories. Also, is your hairdresser your unofficial counsellor? And if you are a hairdresser, do you feel like an unpaid therapist? How's that feel? A new report has found that hairdressers and beauty therapists are quietly carrying an enormous emotional load because so many of us are opening up about everything from relationship breakdowns to domestic violence, from illness to grief, but they're not trained counsellors. And so many are facing burnout. They just don't have the training for how to process all of this. Have you lent on a hairdresser at a critical time? And what did that mean for you? 1300 222 774 or your beautician. I guess it might need to be a beautician that you have a relationship with, or maybe not. What is it about sitting in that chair that does make us want to open up? And if you do work in a salon, how does it land with you? Tell us what the most unexpected or difficult conversation you've been part of has been. 1300 222 774. Are we sharing too much with our hairdressers and beauticians? Also this hour, why the visit from Japan's leader starting today is so important, and what is happening in the Royal Commission's public hearings to receive that first-hand evidence of anti-Semitism. But next, should aged care homes be more open about their policies on voluntary assisted dying?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Fiona Patton, former Member of Parliament and one of the architects, did that first motion that kicked it all off for us in Victoria. Thank you for joining us, Fiona.
Thanks, Mary.
What did you think when you saw the results of this report?
Oh, look, I can't say I was surprised, but I was really disappointed that after we've had this legislation, we passed this legislation back in 2017, we've seen every state in Australia follow Victoria and legalise assisted dying. And to see that aged care facilities are still not recognising that legal right of Victorians to access assisted dying when they meet, you know, the quite significant restrictions to that access here in Victoria. So yeah, was disappointed. Do think that needs to change.
So for people who might not have heard about this report, it shows that they studied 70 aged care providers in the end. 73% of them either don't offer voluntary assisted dying or have unclear access policies, and only 10% offer comprehensive information and full access. Just want to repeat Dr. Linda Swan, who spoke with Raph Epstein this morning. She's the CEO of Go Gentle, and this was the results of them even just trying to find out what the situation was.
We tried to look at this from a consumer perspective, just imagining that we were an older person trying to pick an aged care facility. And we called aged care facilities, we checked on their websites, we wrote letters, we tried to contact the CEOs. we were, in many instances, just completely ignored. People refused to give us any information about did they or did they not support assisted dying. So if you're a normal person just trying to work out, does my local aged care facility support voluntary assisted dying? The answer is, in the vast majority of cases, you just have no idea.
Fiona Patton, how do you respond to that?
No, that's absolutely right. And the legislation, as it stands today in Victoria, largely protects that policy. So it largely protects that. We have got some small changes coming into effect next year that will stop the gag orders, which meant, because in Victoria currently, a doctor cannot even raise the issue of voluntary assisted dying with a patient who is at end of life unless that patient asks first. Now, that is changing, but still, these organisations are protected, and they can say that they have a corporate conscientious objection to assisted dying and not provide information and certainly not provide access to either doctors speaking to those residents of those homes, or, you know, at the very end, accessing this. Now, this was New South Wales recently just tried to introduce legislation to bring New South Wales into line with these quite draconian rules in Victoria, and they were unsuccessful, and it was challenged that if they had done it, it would be unconstitutional. Mm. And I think that Victorian laws are at risk of being found to be unconstitutional because of the 2024 federal aged care rules that were introduced.
So, Fiona Patton, let's step back a bit. You said that they can quote corporate, what was it?
It's I know, it's curious, Mary. It's really curious. It's corporate conscientious objection.
And that means, what do you think?
It means that an organisation can say that our organisation does not provide these services. Now, this is used widely in regards to contraception and abortion services in Victoria, where abortion is legal, but in state-funded public hospitals, they still believe they have the right to refuse access to not only abortions, but contraception, including things like tubal ligations. And this follows on to assisted dying, that the organisation, regardless of the beliefs of their staff, institute an overall prohibition on these legal services.
So if you believe that this is going to be found to be not constitutional, I think you said, what's the next step legally?
Look, the next step could be a challenge. There was some very good advice provided by a Victorian barrister, Patrick Kaiser, and a QC Moses for New South Wales. That's about to be published in the Journal of Medicine and Law. And I think the Health Minister's Office and the Department of Health would be very wise to look at that, because I think their legislation as it stands could be invalid under our constitution that says that Commonwealth law always takes precedent over state. So I would hope it doesn't come to a legal challenge and the cost of a High Court challenge, but I think if we don't see change, that is inevitable.
Fiona Patton, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Mary.
Fiona Patton, yes, was one of the architects of the laws in Victoria. Siobhan, you're in Clifton Hill. What have your experiences been with aged care?
Oh, hi. It was hard to... we didn't get any assisted dying, you know, in place. It wasn't something that we discussed before. It was time. But it was very hard to get any more medication for an easy death. My brother-in-law probably could have passed away, you know, 4 weeks prior to his death. It was kind of cruel. It was actually cruel. Mm. It wasn't kind of cruel.
So you would have liked to have at least known or thought about that as you were going in?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, that would have been great, some information. That would have been great if we were handed any information. Even just being with my husband, being with his brother for, you know, 2.5 years, and then the last sort of 3 weeks with him day and night, he had to beg for medication for more pain relief. It was just cruel. And also, they didn't give us any information about what to expect when someone is dying, and these are the stages of a dying person. You know, there was no handbill or a booklet or any sort of, it was sort of not even discussed really. Of, you know, there was no.
No support as to at that very end of life. Yes. Oh, Siobhan, I'm so sorry about that experience that you've had, and I wonder if others have shared that experience, lack of support at the end of life. We are talking about the report from Go Gentle that highlights the lack of information and transparency around the facility's attitude towards voluntary assisted dying. Samantha Edmonds is Director of Policy and Education at OPAN, which is the Older Persons Advocacy Network, and has written a forward, OPAN has, to that report, in Go Gentle's report. Samantha, thanks for joining us. What do you believe is the most important thing to take from this report?
Thanks, Mary. Look, I think one of the most important things is that there is a requirement that aged care providers should enable access to voluntary assisted dying. They should have very clear policies available that people can read and know before they're making that decision to enter into residential aged care. You don't want to be moving into a residential aged care home and then finding out once you're in there that they actually won't support you in any way to access voluntary assisted dying. So really important those policies are up front so people can make well thought out decisions and understand, you know, any barriers they may face once they're in that residential aged care home. Like, will they need to consider how they're going to access voluntary assisted dying, how they're going to connect to those services, what supports, if any or none, that provider is going to do. So I think that the biggest and most important thing is that clear communication so people understand what they're going to face when they move into residential care.
Mm. You're listening to Samantha Edmonds from OPAN. We should also say that we did invite the head of Ageing Australia to come and speak to us, and Ageing Australia is the peak body for those providers. Unfortunately, the CEO is travelling and couldn't join us today. But Samantha, in terms of the validity of this report, have you seen cases of people actually being denied the voluntary assisted dying, and how does that happen if it is legal?
So we've had a few cases. We haven't had a lot, but, you know, when you're in that situation where you're very vulnerable, it's very emotional, you know, you're not necessarily going to be thinking about reaching out to an advocacy service to get support. So we've only had a few cases come in, and I think some of those are very similar to the ones in the report itself, and that includes things like someone wanting to use voluntary assisted dying. The provider wouldn't support them in accessing that service, and so the person then had to leave the service at a time, you know, when you're sort of at that point in your life and you're about to access this service, you don't want to be moving out of what is essentially your home, and being forced to move out of that at a, you know, when you're very unwell. Yeah. So,
well, tell us about that. What is the impact of this?
Well, obviously, it's removing choice. I mean, under the New Aged Care Act, older people have a right to make decisions and choices about their life. So it's removing that very clear choice. It's putting the older person in a very compromised position in terms of their health and their end of life experience. So what could potentially be a positive experience, a supported experience with your loved ones, suddenly you're trying to find somewhere else to go. You've got to go to hospital. It might not be where you want to be. You know, so all those other things and other stresses that can impact on you and your family at a time when it should just be the support that you can, you know, die well at the time you've chosen.
Yeah. Samantha, what do you believe will be the next step here? I have on text, you know, there are many, many boomers coming through the system. We know this. Sorry to anyone who objects to that term, but we know that there are many people who are going to go through this sector. Do you think that this is going to become more of an issue as we go on, inevitably?
I think it will. And I think as, you know, the providers understand the laws, we've got the rights in the Aged Care Act, we've had the Quality and Safety Commission clearly stating that providers should support access to voluntary assisted dying. And as I think people become more aware of it and see it as a you know, another end of life option, that we're going to see greater pressure to allow and enable access to voluntary assisted dying.
Samantha, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Samantha Edmonds, Director of Policy and Education at OPAN. This on text as well about... I'm just getting it. It's a long story from Lisa from Inverloch, but it's about her mum dying at the age of 95, and her last few months of her life were full of pain, and she wanted, eventually was given comfort care. And as mum's advocate, Lisa says, I was treated as if I was trying to kill my mum. And one doctor said to me my mum was passively suicidal. Tricky, such a terrible situation at the best of times, and sometimes these are not the best of times. Peter from Caulfield, what do you have to say, Peter?
Really love what you're doing out there. I'm imploring people who have concerns with the New Aged Care Act and supported home in particular to put in submissions through to the Senate. It's all very well as talking about it among ourselves, but if we put in a submission through to the Senate, it can be very simple, it could be 100 words, whatever your story is, the Senate will then be able to put it with others and address these matters where it should be in Parliament. But if they're not aware of the numbers and they're not aware of the number of people who have concerns, there's very little they can do. Mm. Normally, there would be around about 200 or 300 submissions going through to the Senate. I've got a personal target of trying to get 1,000 on people to put in a submission. It's very simple. All they've got to do
on this issue, Peter?
Sorry?
On this issue, Peter?
On this issue, yeah. On any issue relating to aged care support.
Peter, thank you. That's very foot forward of you. And, that's one bit of advice. Ben Rogers is CEO of the Council for the Aging and Senior Rights Victoria. Maybe Ben has some more advice. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. What is your advice for people who are in a situation where they're trying to find out about a facility's attitude towards voluntary assisted dying?
I think it really boils down to asking. It shouldn't. It really shouldn't. They should be very sort of public with their policies and their approach. And we really would encourage a lot of the providers, as captured in Go Gentle's report, to be more forthright so that people can be more discerning as they go through the process. But ask. And if they say that they can't because of the gag clause, which is still technically in effect in Victoria until April 2027, you can kindly remind them that it does not apply to them, essentially signifying what their corporate response is. And the gag clause only relates to medical practitioners.
So can you just explain that a little more about the gag clause and how it doesn't apply?
So with the gag clause under the initial voluntary assisted dying regulation essentially meant that medical practitioners were prohibited from initiating conversations about voluntary assisted dying with their patients. And from what we can see in terms of coverage of Go Gentle Australia's report is that some providers are saying that they don't feel comfortable or confident to put forward their public position because it may be in contravention of the gag clause. It definitely doesn't apply just because they're not medical practitioners, and also there are providers that are doing this. So I think it's a case of gently encouraging them with their process, but especially by April 2027, there should be absolutely no prohibitions on these providers being very clear with their potential residents what their views are on voluntary assisted dying.
And do you agree with Samantha from OPAN, Ben, that this is only going to become a bigger issue?
Absolutely. It's only going to become a bigger issue, but especially because we are going through aged care reform. You know, these things do take time to bed in, but it's why we need to keep on top of this and keep reminding providers of their obligations towards residents and older Victorians to make sure that they get the best possible experience. You know, dying is the last stage of life, and it's something that we really need to, you know, encourage the agency of the older person, however they want to die, whatever a good death looks like for them. And especially with the numbers of people going into residential aged care, it's important that they are facilitating it, as is captured under the new standards.
Thank you so much for joining the conversation, Ben. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Ben Rogers, who is CEO of Council for the Aging and Senior Rights Victoria. Keep those calls and texts coming in. We want to hear about real-life experiences when it comes to this. It sounds like on many different levels there are still so many things we need to get right about that particular stage of life, which is death.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, when have you opened up to a hairdresser or a beautician, and why did you do it? Why did it feel easier there than in other places in your life? And if you work in a salon, how does it land with you to hear some really quite grim stuff, I'm sure? Tell me about your experiences, whether you're in the chair or behind the chair. A new report has found that the people who are standing behind you or over you, those hairdressers and beauty therapists, are quietly carrying a big emotional load, but they're not trained. And many say they're going home carrying stories they don't know how to process. Dr. Hannah McCann from the University of Melbourne has been researching this and spoken to hundreds of salon workers and clients across Australia. And she joins me now. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Why did you start studying this? When did it hit you that this was more than just anecdotal and something to really get your teeth into as a researcher?
Yeah, so this report's based on almost a decade of work interviewing and surveying different salon workers and their clients. And I kind of just fell into it. At the beginning, I was asking questions of workers around, like, you know, how you have to look for work in terms of how you present yourself. Mm. And they were like, oh, yeah, I guess there's this kind of pressure to present myself in a particular way. But the real work is emotional work. And so I just followed that and it turned into this huge project. The report's also been written with Stacey Page at Adelaide University, who used to be a hairdresser and is doing a PhD on this as well.
Oh, that is fascinating. A decade's worth of research. 1300 222 774, if your experience you feel could actually add to Hannah's decade of research, what do you tell your hairdresser and why? And maybe has it made a real difference to you? If you are a hairdresser, how does carrying that load affect you? 1300 222 774. Over that time, that's a long time. Have things always been? Has it improved or has it gotten worse?
That's a great question. So what we've seen over this decade is a lot of kind of ad hoc training popping up, especially around domestic violence training for salon workers all across the world. So there's this increasing recognition of the role that salon workers play in people's lives and the unique location they have in communities. So you have a salon in every corner, and it means that salon workers are connected to marginalized and vulnerable communities. So you have these kind of ad hoc training things coming up across the world, but there's not much systematic training.
Right. And as you say, domestic violence is a huge part of it. But what else do they cop?
Absolutely everything that happens in life comes into the salon. So I also worked in a salon for 6 weeks as part of this research. And it was really interesting because when I'd been interviewing salon workers, I was really thinking of this as a burden. But what I experienced in the salon is it's also a joy, because you're let into people's, you know, every moment of their life, the texture of their life. And it's really wonderful. If you like people, this is a fantastic social job, but it is also social work a lot of the time. And when people are feeling bad, they go to the salon to feel better. So there's a lot of crying in the chair.
A lot of crying, hopefully crying with happiness. Fascinating to go from the research world to popping yourself in a salon. Were you surprised by the level of sharing?
Look, I have to say, you know, most conversations are light. You know, not everyone is doing deep and meaningful confessions in the chair, but you would be surprised at how frequently things come up. It can be 10 in the morning and someone is going to their father's funeral that afternoon. Mm. And, you know, these key moments in people's lives are being expressed in the chair. So people are talking about things like terminal illness. They're talking about violence. They're talking about, you know, mental health concerns that they have. And salon workers are not trained systematically. This is not part of fundamental conversations unless registered training organizations are taking the initiative to have those training conversations, but there's nothing systematically embedded. And so people are coming into the industry very young, 16, having pretty hardcore conversations. And, you know, it's not just the conversations, they're managing people's bodies too. Connected to your earlier conversation about elderly people, salon workers are sometimes the only people that touch the clients, you know, their heads, they're giving them massages. And that's really important for people, for their well-being. So they're playing this vital role in people's lives.
Yeah. And as you say, can unlock, yes, some bad things, but hopefully some good things as well. 1300 222 774. Tell me what you are like with your hairdresser, or what life is like as a hairdresser. John, you've called from New South Wales. You have a salon, is that right?
Yes, I do. I've been working for a fair while now, 60 years. I started in Melbourne with Lily and Frank in the, when it was Lily and Antonio.
Right, the glam
in college trip. Yeah, yeah. Well, now what I was ringing about really was your conversation regarding this situation. Is years ago in Deniliquin, a lady came from Wangaratta and did what she referred to as a gatekeeper's course, and it was very, very good for hairdressers to do this gatekeeper's course, because if anyone had a problem, they could always advise the client, yeah, look, why don't you go here? Why don't you go there? It's not a bad idea to do it and start that sort of thing.
So that was a gatekeeper's course in terms of social services, is that right?
Yes, yes, right. Yes.
Yep.
And another thing that they really should concentrate on too for hairdressers, especially around the facial areas and that, being spotters for skin cancers.
John, just as you spoke, Brian from Mornington texted in the same thing. They need more training in skin cancers that clients can't see. So it sounds like they're juggling a lot more than scissors and razors, John.
Of course, that does happen. I mean, like, I've been at it for a while. Yep. And look, on a weekly basis...
Did it wear on you, John?
No, not at all. Not at all. I was brought up in hotels in my early life, so I've had the full gamut of all sorts of people. And, look, I can cope with it. It's not a real problem. And I enjoy talking to my clients about these sorts of things. And if I can be helpful, I'm always happy if I can be helpful.
Oh, John, you sound like the best hairdresser. Thank you so much for calling in, Hannah. That really is, the highs and the lows of it there. But skin cancers and, I guess, a whole heap of other things that hairdressers feel that they need to look out for.
Absolutely. Since the 1970s, there's been research talking about hairdressers and beauty workers as lay health educators, which is they can do things like melanoma detection, they can do outreach around things like diabetes or breast cancer awareness. And this is really mobilised in the United States in a very different way to Australia, where there's a lot more of this kind of public health outreach via salons. It's a real space of opportunity in Australia. But we really need to make sure that we're not putting too much burden on salon workers. And that's why we're advocating in this report for a wellbeing unit at a fundamental level, systematically for all hair and beauty workers. We've written the unit. It could be adopted.
So who would supply that unit?
Yeah, so that would be the registered training organisations when people are getting their first certificates in hairdressing and barbering or beauty services. And so it's really... The really important thing is when you have services like domestic violence places or you know, public health initiatives, a lot of the time they're coming in with their own kind of agenda about reaching the community, which is really important. But we also have to keep in mind the well-being of the salon workers themselves. Like, we're not asking them to do more. We're asking them to refer to other services so that they're not taking that on themselves.
And to be prepared rather than to have to do more.
To know what is out there to help their clients so that they're not feeling like they have to be the one messaging their client late at night to check on their mental health. And that does happen, and it leads to burnout. That's the findings in the research.
We are talking to Dr. Hannah McCann, who's a senior lecturer in culture studies at Melbourne University, talking about the emotional load that is borne by our hairdressers and salon therapists. Give us a call, 1300 222 774, if you've been on either side of that relationship. Hannah, if this training module that you've, you know, done, prepared earlier, isn't put in or something similar, what is the effect on the worker? Are we seeing burnout and crashing out of the industry, or what are the effects?
Yes, the research shows that without support for the kind of work that hair and beauty workers are expected to do, they are burning out, they're dropping out of the industry, and really there's a strong indication that what is needed is some kind of fundamental training. So if that doesn't happen, let's imagine that we continue without this kind of unit. What registered training organisations can do is find opportunities in the existing curriculum to have this conversation and at least introduce the idea to people that when they get into the salon, this is what they're going to encounter and this is what they can do.
Yeah. This on text as well. Definitely people confide in their hairdressers and there's certainly an emotional toll there. They deal with heavy moments and I praise them for that. Hannah, you were talking about domestic violence in particular and referring to services. You know,
What would you have to say, I guess, to hairdressers who are listening today, and you know, the young apprentices and so forth, in terms of advice in lieu of your training? What would you have to say to them?
Yeah, so one thing that salons that want to be proactive about this, that they can do, they can look at the local services that are around, and they can support their staff to know what kinds of places they can refer their clients to. They can also set up debriefing mechanisms in the salon to say, if you hear something really difficult, we can have this space to talk about it later, and not just kind of have a burnout party culture of like, we're not ever going to talk about these difficult things. One thing that's really interesting about salon work is that you can have a really difficult interaction, you know, a really upsetting disclosure. It might be triggering to you personally, like it's something that you've also experienced, a death in the family or so on. And then you have to immediately switch to the next client.
Yeah.
Like you just have to be professional and keep going. And so even within a salon, to have a recognition of that emotional aspect of the work and something that's open and can be discussed as part of the salon team,
yeah,
I think is very meaningful for people.
Part of the workflow. Hannah, thank you for your decade of work, and good luck with the rest of your research.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Hannah McCann, who is from Melbourne University, looking into that burden that so many hairdressers and beauticians are wearing. Emma, you've called in from Essendon. What's your experience in the salon like?
Yeah, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes. I just texted in because I guess I have a little bit of an alternate view. I have friends that are hairdressers. I fully support, and I actually agree that hairdressers do absorb a lot of those emotional times, especially like, yeah, things like funerals or people going through difficult times in their lives. But I guess from my perspective, I actually really hate going to the hairdresser because for me, I don't get much time to myself. I really just want to go there, sit down, read my book. And I know it takes maybe an hour or two to do your hair, so I kind of just want to sit there and read my book in silence. But I avoid going to the hairdresser because it's just,
Did he just keep
talking?
Emma, maybe you should find that hairdresser who just, you know, doesn't want to hear it anymore.
Do you know what? They're probably on the edge of that, and I think there's an element of everyone's trying to be polite. My actual problem is I can't put into words, I just need a little bit of quiet. Do you mind if I just sit here? And I can do that to you, but in the moment, because I then have to sit there for a few hours, I feel like, I've been very...
I know.
And like it's not the social norm to do that.
Yeah, there's pressure either way. Emma, thank you. That is a really good perspective. There are some days where I'm sure both client and hairdresser just doesn't want to talk about it. In fact, this on text, what about when the roles are reversed and the client is taking on the struggles and anxieties of the hairdresser or beautician? It's complex, isn't it? I hope the hair is good anyway.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi has touched down in Canberra for one-on-one talks. And as we've heard, the federal government ruled out that new tax proposal on gas exports, in part because of fears that it could alienate major Asian trading partners like Japan. So if the gas export tax is off the table, what will they be talking about? Joining me now is Nick Bisley, Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University. Nick, thanks for your time.
Pleasure to be with you.
What's the purpose of this trip?
Well, the formal purpose is to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the treaty that established sort of formal relations between Japan and Australia after the Second World War. But more importantly, what this is really about is a couple of, firstly, drawing more of an underline between a very close security and defence partnership that's been developing for really nearly 20 years, where Australia and Japan have essentially become one another's most important security partner after their respective alliance with the United States. And then secondly, and perhaps more pointedly in the current context, is about economic security. And this is both about the energy concerns that both countries have because of the war in Iran, and then the longer run concerns that have been building up related to supply chain resilience, critical minerals, and various other things that are really about the geopolitical contest between the US and China. So this is a pretty important meeting for both countries. This is a really significant bilateral relationship, and one which I think the foundations were laid, 10 or 15 years ago, where both sides looked at each other and saw, as the phrase goes, kind of like-minded democracies with shared interests in, trade and defence and various other things. But it's been really sort of foresighted to be able to be in the position to tighten things up as they are trying to do now.
How important would you describe this relationship, particularly now in the shadow of the Iranian war, in the sort of shifting geopolitical landscape?
Look, I think it's hard to overstate it in one sense. Mm. Japan remains a critical economic partner. It's our third biggest trading partner. And the energy trade, particularly gas, is really important both for them and for us. In the geopolitical kind of turmoil that we're in, both countries are sort of caught between China and the United States. And as the US has become, how to put it politely, more unpredictable under the United States and certainly more self-interested, the countries that are caught in the middle, like us and Japan, have to depend on one another a good deal more, and they have to look after themselves more as well. And for each other, for Japan and Australia, we're both countries that have a huge amount at stake in terms of, a stable international economic order to ensure that trade lines remain open. We are, as the smaller partner, much more dependent to some degree than Japan is, but we both will be able to advance things considerably more together than if we try to do it individually. So, as I said before, I think for both countries, this is probably the most important relationship they have after their ties with, respectively, China and the US. And the timing of this is really, really crucial.
Mm. You're listening to Nick Bisley, Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University. We're talking about the visit from Japan's PM. And Nick, Prime Minister Takaichi is known as having a hawkish approach to China. How does that fit into her and her country's relationship with Australia right at this moment?
Yeah, I think the perception that she's hawkish is, I think, probably a little overdone. She's certainly out of the sort of conservative tradition in Japan, one that looks out at a rising China and feels uneasy about this. But, it's a long way. It's not 1935 again in Japan under Takaichi-sensei. Takaichi-san, sorry, I've got my titles wrong there. She certainly has ruffled feathers in Beijing by putting probably the thing that she's done most recently is made clear that the Taiwan contingency, as the phrase is termed, that's to say, if China was to attack Taiwan, this would be a critical issue for Japan. And the conservatives and nationalists in China have taken this as, this is provocative and this is destabilizing, when for most people it's a statement of the geopolitically blaringly obvious. And I think probably the most important thing that she's done recently has loosened the constitutional constraints on exports of armaments. So what that means for Australia is opportunities to diversify from whom we acquire our military capability. So at the moment, we're very, very dependent on the US. We are beginning to look at ways in which we're trying to diversify that, and the position that she's taken in relation to these things, I think, is helpful for that broader agenda.
Well, and it's notable that just on the eve of this visit, it's reported that a former senior defence official has said that Australia's plan to acquire those nuclear-powered submarines through AUKUS is so risky that we should actually be asking to lease submarines from Japan as a fallback option. This is an interesting contribution right at this point in time.
Submarines. So you can't go far without it coming up.
Richard Gray, who has been in a few different defence roles.
Yeah. I think that's not what they're going to be talking about in the next day or two. Certainly, if you're doing long-range planning around submarines and you're trying to do a worst-case scenario planning in the event that AUKUS goes south, Japan would have to be part of the conversation just because they can produce submarines, high-quality submarines in relatively large volumes relatively quickly. If we were to enter into some arrangement as a in you know, there's so many ifs and buts around it, but I think that they're certainly positioned to be able to help us in the event that that is needed, but would be so far down a difficult scenario that it's very a long way from where we currently are to make that a bit of a hypothetical exercise.
So, Nick Bisler, what do you think would be the sort of the benchmark of success from this visit and, in fact, for the relationship?
Well, I think what most of us are expecting is probably some further details around, specifically around energy security questions immediately related to Iran, the Iran wars and the shortages in the Asia Pacific. But longer run, I think we're probably likely to see something around supply chain resilience, critical minerals. They've been a key part of what we're trying to do and a key priority for Japan, in which you know we have very complementary interests. And I think if you see a further development of the security ties formalized into areas like cybersecurity and the like, then I think you'd have both sides, Tokyo and Canberra, be very pleased with the outcomes. I'd be pretty optimistic that we're going to reach some kinds of these sorts of headline deals. Mm-hmm. The groundwork's been laid. The relationship is very strong. Both sides trust each other, and I think both sides really need to move the needle on all of these issues.
Nick Bisley, thank you for your time.
Pleasure.
Nick Bisley is a professor of international relations at La Trobe University. So that trip is still to play out. We'll see what happens there. Earlier this hour, we were talking about the unpaid emotional load on hairdressers and beauticians in our life. And there have been quite a few texts saying, I really don't like to talk at the hairdresser. Tracy says, my daughter is a hairdresser who will ask if you want to talk or sit in quiet. And Lisa in Warrnambool says, my salon has quiet appointments so you can book in. So if you book in, you can opt to have a silent appointment. It's a great idea because some days you just need it. Yes. I think not long ago we had a program talking about icebreakers and how to start conversations. Maybe we should have one about how to shut them down. And Sophie is thinking, do ABC presenters have a similar experience of being accidental counsellors at risk of burnout? Not me, Sophie. Call me anytime, anytime. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. It is 11 minutes to 12 on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. And also today, the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion is opening its first public hearings. We'll find out what's happening there next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 11 minutes to 12. Well, joining me now is ABC reporter and one-time London Bureau colleague of mine, Barbara Miller. Thanks for joining us, Barb.
Good to be with you, Mary.
So the first public hearings are happening in the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism. What's the overview on day one?
So this block of hearings, and it's going to last a couple of weeks, will look into the nature and prevalence of anti-Semitism in Australia. It's really focusing on the lived experience of Jewish Australians. And we heard that today's evidence will focus on what Commissioner Virginia Bell called ugly displays of hostility towards Jewish Australians. That includes adults and children. And in some opening remarks, Mary, Commissioner Bell said that Australia, as was the case in other Western nations, had experienced a sharp spike in anti-Semitism following the Hamas attacks in Israel on October the 7th, 2023, and Israel's response to them. And we also had some opening remarks from Council Assisting Zelie Hager. She talked about how in the submissions the Commission has received so far, Jewish Australians have talked about how anti-Semitism is impacting the way they feel and move throughout the world, and the way some of them present. Some of them have told the Commission in their submissions that when they're in public, they try and conceal their identity. And Zelie Hager gave us a taste of some of the harrowing stories that we are going to hear. She talked, for example, about an incident where a school student told a Jewish student, this was on a public bus, she said, that Hitler should have gassed them all. So when you hear that kind of testimony, you get a sense why Virginia Bell was keen to let everyone know that it was some pretty ugly stories that we were going to be hearing over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. Barbara, do we have any idea of who's going to be giving evidence today?
Yeah, we've heard from the first witnesses that the very first one to take the stand was the daughter of one of the 15 people shot dead at Bondi last December. That was Reuven Morrison. He, we heard, was a refugee from the Soviet Union, and he'd actually met his wife on Bondi Beach. And his daughter, Shana Gutnik, told the commission, you know, that Bondi was once such a beautiful place for the Jewish community, a place of such joy. But of course, now people have very mixed emotions about Bondi. She also talked about her personal experience of anti-Semitism, and she said that she's constantly weighing up whether it's safe to go out in public places. There are certain places she says she avoids. She thinks about where she should pick up a parcel if she's doing click and collect. And she says that's because of very real abuse that she has suffered. And she described one incident where she was walking through Westfield at Bondi Junction, the big shopping centre there, with her young baby, and a man pointed at her Star of David, a necklace she was wearing, and called her an effing terrorist. Oh. And she said it's incidents like that that understandably make her feel exposed and unsafe. She said no one intervened, and because she was with her 12-month-old baby, she just tried to get away as quickly as she could.
You're listening to Barbara Miller, who is reporting from the first public hearings from the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion. Barbara, what's happening from here in the commission hearings?
Well, today we expect to hear from a total of about 12 witnesses. Now, some of those, including a couple we've already heard from, have their identities suppressed. They're being referred to only as AAK, for example, the first one, the next one AAL. That's because they fear that if their identity is published, that their security could be further at risk. We expect, as I said, this block of hearings to run for a couple of weeks. Now, further blocks of hearings will take place, including, we heard, in Melbourne. That's going to be, I believe, in July, a block of hearings there with you in Melbourne. Those hearings, the further hearings, will focus on issues including the circumstances surrounding the Bondi attacks, the drivers and the prevalence of anti-Semitism in institutions and schools, and the drivers of radicalization. So an awful lot to get through, and submissions still coming into this Royal Commission thick and fast. We heard that the number has now reached 7,500. That's double the number there was just about a week and a half ago. Mm. Of course, the release of the interim report last week probably encouraged more people to come forward. Making a submission, if anyone's thinking about it, does not mean that you have to come before the commission, as certain people will be invited, of course, if they're not comfortable doing that. There is absolutely no obligation for their submission or their identity to be made public.
Yeah. Good note for anyone who's listening. Bob, thank you for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Barbara Miller, ABC reporter, talking from the first public hearings in that Royal Commission. Earlier this hour, we were talking about that wonderful role that hairdressers play in our lives, sometimes as unpaid therapists. Lisa, you've called in from Eltham. What's your relationship with your hairdresser like?
Hi, Mary. I did text, but my relationship with my hairdresser is about to end. I've had my second last appointment just this morning, and finishing seeing him in June after 35 years.
Oh, so it wasn't about the bad haircuts or anything?
No. No, sadly for both of us, he's retiring.
Oh. And has he been important to you, Lisa?
Oh, very. I mean, it's just, he's a fabulous hairdresser. But his name is William, and a fabulous hairdresser, but a beautiful soul, beautiful connection and friendship that we've had over the time. And we're not friends outside of the hair salon, but we don't connect that way, but we know each other's journeys intimately, and we've always listened and been there for each other, and it's been wonderful.
Mm. Mm.
So very, very sad. It'll be a huge loss.
Absolutely. Oh, look, yeah. Good on you, Lisa, for calling, and good on you, William, for all of those wonderful years, and have a wonderful retirement. And also this on text, someone who is saying that the hairdresser was starting to tell her about her relationship breakup. She got more and more invested in the story and the hair was coming off my head at an alarming rate. I didn't like to say anything, but I ended up with a lot shorter haircut than I'd imagined. The perils. Thank you for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. The email to write to me is conversationhour@abc.net.au, and also you can find us on the ABC Listen app. Have a great day today. Take care, and I'll talk to you all tomorrow.